Time now for the Yahoo Sports College Podcast with Pete Thamel.
I'm a terrible stat person. I'm a terrible numbers person. Pretty much a terrible person.
And SI's Pat Forty.
I was at Kentucky Duke in 92, and the similarities between that game and this game were profound. All right, welcome to the late night post-NCAA tournament championship version of the pod. If you think I don't sound like Dan Wetzel, you're correct. I am not Dan Wetzel. I'm Pat Forty. I am joined by Pete Thamel. And Wetzel, the last that we heard from him was getting soused on the beach in Marco Island. This is kids' spring break. And we kept getting a succession of pictures from Dan of, you know, buckets of beer, cocktail glasses. I think there might have even been a wine glass in there. It was very obnoxious taunting that while we have been grinding it out in the pseudo bubble, Dan has been lollygagging. He's still lollygagging. We should get him back later this week. But for now, you got me and you got Pete, who are both in Indy, both at the Section 8 Residence Inn, as Pete lovingly dubbed it. A rather sketchy Residence Inn. I mean, the rooms are fine. The clientele's a little. But we've been here since, like, Carmelo Anthony was in college. And we will happily go home tomorrow.
Yeah, 40 weeks from now, Pat, we'll be here for the national title game in football. So maybe we just shouldn't leave.
Oh, right? Yeah. Yeah, right.
No, we won't actually be in this hotel, thankfully. But I hope not.
No. But, yeah. Yeah, that's right. There's a lot of Indy in our future.
Yes.
But in our present, our immediate past, and in our future. But, well, we're gonna break down the championship game, and boy, did it suck. What a wild anticlimax. Pete, what the hell was that?
Six-minute pod where 4 minutes we make fun of Dan for, like, bailing out on working, like, the actual, like, one of the most important weeks of the year to be a sports writer? I think the best way to sum this up, and I wish I had thought of this analysis for the two columns that I wrote tonight, was Baylor made Gonzaga look like one of the many WCC teams Gonzaga dominates during the year. Like, there was, like, just a distinct level of superiority. So I give Scott Drew and Baylor a lot of credit. They knew they'd have mismatches on the perimeter. They found them consistently and just feasted on them. Poor Drew Timmy lost a lot of money tonight because his feet were covered in cement. He was completely outmatched. And look, for as good as he looked against Evan Mobley, he looked unbelievably bad against Flo Thamba and Everyday Jonathan. Like, he just completely looked like he got swallowed alive in this game. He was flailing on the floor. I give Baylor a ton of credit because they have unbelievable trio of guards, and Gonzaga had no chance of matching up with them, and they just put them in a blender on every play. They just spun around the perimeter, got the mismatch they wanted, and then went right to the hoop or kicked it out for an open three. I think I saw at one point they were 7 of 10 on guarded threes. So look, they had a little bit of mojo tonight, but they actually I thought they'd be shooting 70% at halftime, right? Now, they got so many offensive rebounds, and it just kept it alive. But I believe the stat to me that I'll remember from this game, Pat, was Gonzaga attempted 22 shots in the first half, and Baylor made 19 field goals. Like, Gonzaga couldn't get the Zags couldn't get the ball up or off. They had 8 turnovers at halftime, and quite frankly, anything that happened in the second half didn't really matter. There was 26 precious seconds where the lead was cut to single digits. So I was like, you know, you're trying to write because I had to file at the end of the game. I kind of looked up. I was like, oh, it's 9. And then somebody hit 3. And I was like, all right, we're back to the computer screen and going. So Baylor is a team definitely constructed to compete in modern college basketball. And they just simply picked Gonzaga apart in every phase. They beat him in special teams. They beat him in offense. They beat him in defense. There was, roll tide. That's what it felt like.
Yeah, I know. It did feel like the football championship, you're right, because it was not close. And it was not close immediately. I mean, it was 9-0 to start. The first possession, Baylor got 3 shots because they were hammering the glass. And boy, was that going to be a theme. And the other part of that theme was, like, Drew Timmy's just getting whipped for the ball. You know, I mean, like he's not really even going after the ball. And Mark Vidal's just like, I'll go get it. And then Jalen Suggs, who was the one guy, you know, the athlete that could match up the perimeter guys for Baylor. He gets two fouls in 3 minutes and just like right there. It's like, this is a nightmare for Gonzaga. This is over. I mean, you know, you figure 29-0 that maybe they're going to make a run, and they just never did. It just never got any better from a fan standpoint of wanting to see one more great game and wanting to see this matchup that we thought we were going to get in December and then evaporated, and all season long thinking, okay, these are the two best teams. You thinking, okay, we're going to get a brawl at the very least. I mean, just a great game, a really competitive, close game. And from the literal first possession onward, it was not that. Credit, obviously, as you alluded to Baylor. They were so ready. You know, they were dialed in, and they just attacked immediately. So aggressive. You know, I think you even noted on Twitter that few kept saying they were the aggressor. They were more aggressive, and it's 100% true. And they just didn't respond. A couple of things I wanted to hit on with you. Let's start with just the program perception and coaches' perception now and what this does. Obviously, you know, Scott Drew has been a guy who has had a lot of success but couldn't get to the top. There were people who said they thought he was a bad in-game coach. He had the NCAA flameouts a couple of times. There were people who thought he was a cheater early in his career. What now are we saying about Scott Drew? And then what are we saying about Mark Few's Gonzaga program?
You know, Scott Drew's an interesting case. I think, and you probably would agree, just, you know, we both covered this sport for a while. I don't think there were a whole lot of coaches toasting this win tonight. Certainly not in the Big 12. Certainly not people who went over. Now, Scott Drew is a very nice man, tries very hard to be liked. I don't think there was like a, I'm trying to think of like when Gary Williams won the title, it was, you know, 20 years, win for the good guy, the big sweater. I don't think there will be, that vibe going on with Scott Drew, but I give him credit. He built the quintessential modern basketball team. And I think reluctantly this ascends him, reluctantly meaning from the college basketball, everyday college basketball coach, right? This ascends him into a class and really becoming the face of what I wrote a little bit about this week with Roy Williams. And we can talk about, I'm sure, in some offseason pod, but like, who are the, you know, with Roy Williams gone and, you know, the Boeheim, Huggins, Krzyzewski types on their way out and the game changing enough where they're probably going to be more willing to go out sooner than later. Like, Scott Drew is going to be one of the faces of the sport in the future. Now, that will burn certain coaches. I mean, Rick Barnes was pretty critical of him publicly early on in his tenure there. Rick Pitino was certainly critical of him early on. Like, he tweaked the establishment the wrong way. There was an NCAA investigation that didn't find a ton of stuff. But I would think via his peers, Scott Drew was guilty by consensus. If that's maybe a would you agree with that assessment, Pat?
Yeah. No, and again, there was complaining, you know, people didn't like him. There was some smoke, but I don't think there was ever fire, you know. I mean, to the best of my knowledge, Baylor never had any appreciable sanctions for basketball since he's been there. So,
well, that investigation, you know, ended up with some secondary stuff. It was like phone calls.
Okay.
And this is probably 6-7 years ago now that came down. It was a couple-year investigation, and he kind of spun it as like an exoneration, like anybody, you know, they go under the hood that long in any program, they're going to find some, you know, phone calls and text messages and everything. Like, I think Scott Drew will remain divisive within the sport, if that makes sense. But he certainly acquitted himself. The bad in, I was at the 2016 12-5 game when they lost to Yale. And it was the famous Tayshaun Prince when they asked him about getting out rebounded, and he gave some like deadpan answer, like, they jumped up and grabbed the ball more than us answer. I don't know if you remember that game at all, but yes, I do remember. I was working for Sports Illustrated, further proof that they'll hire anyone at the time. And yes, I totally ripped Scott Drew for losing to Yale, because they shouldn't have lost to Yale. They had Torian Prince, for crying out loud. Like, I think when people get niched, like, I mean, Jim Boeheim was a bad coach in the 80s, right? When he loses to Richmond in a 15-2 game, it's hard to shake that. Bill Self had that stigma hanging over him when he loses. Who did he lose to? Bucknell? Like, Bill Self's one of the best in-game coaches in the country now. I think Jim Boeheim's an excellent game coach, you know, as it's evolved. And I really think it's hard to argue with Scott Drew as a game coach right now. But I do think there's there is like an intriguing tension that will always sort of hover over Drew. I would not say he has been embraced by the hierarchical mainstream of the game.
Yeah, no, I think that's very true. And yeah, he goes about it a bit differently. You know, I mean, he did have the people that, yeah, in the Big 12 that didn't like him, or Bob Knight was one of them. Bob Knight was one of the other guys that was critical of him publicly.
Yeah.
And he wears his religion on his sleeve. That may turn off some people, it may endear some people, but you know, one of the first things they did after they win and they had their celebration out there Monday night, Drew calls the team together. Hey, let's pray. Let's pray. And they get in the circle and they pray. And you know, when Drew gets in there and the first thing he's going to say on the postgame press conference is, you know, glory to God and that sort of thing. And that's, you know, it works for him. That's who he is. First of all, that is who he is. And it also is something that he kind of flaunts to a degree in recruiting. You know, some kids are going to gravitate to that, but yeah, the point you were making there that, I mean, there is no longer any reason to question his coaching. You know, I mean, he can prepare them. He can X and O, he can manage a game. Like tonight, Gonzaga is so out of answers that they go zone, two different zones, 2-3 and a 1-3-1 with a trap. And they never play zone, but that's how bad a position they were in. Which right there was a sign, oh boy, this is bad. But it worked for a couple possessions. But then Baylor figured it out. And then they're getting the shots, and they've got the best three-point shooting team in the country, and they start nailing them. And that's, you know, you adjust, I'll adjust to your adjustment, and then I'll beat you. It was impressive by Drew and by Baylor. You know, you look at the rosters. You've mentioned a couple times modern basketball. You got transfers from, not from powerhouses by any stretch. You know, you have Maceo Teague, who was from North Carolina Asheville. You have Davion Mitchell. He came from Auburn, but
he was a pretty highly regarded recruit.
He was. Yeah. Adam Flagler was from Presbyterian. You got two guys from the SoCon who are out there helping you win a national championship. You know, and a 6'5 post guy in Mark Vital. So, I mean, he's put together a roster in a really interesting way, and it's worked.
Yeah, and they have the ability to just kind of go small and kill you, but they also have answers if you go big. And I just really think, like, the image I'll remember from this game, which really did not have any particularly compelling moments or interesting things to happen.
None.
Is just Timmy rumbling, bumbling, stumbling around the court and being overmatched. Now, you can attribute it to one team like coasted through the semifinal and the other one played an all-time game, and maybe that had something to do with it. You had a tweet early in the game, Pat, where one team was in quicksand and the other team like looked fresh, you know. But hey, credit to Baylor. They were the ones who completely curb stomped Houston and put themselves in position to look fresh and be fresh and play fresh.
Yeah.
So all the credit to them for positioning themselves that way. But it was just, there was a spark to Baylor that wasn't on the other side. And I almost give few credit for going zone. We've seen so many coaches in this tournament.
Yeah. Oh,
like,
yeah.
Think about Brad Underwood. God, Brad Underwood still hasn't made an adjustment. Like, I'd be surprised. Yeah. from that Loyola game. I mean, you just, like, some of these coaches, like, you got to try something if you're getting completely outmanned. And the interesting about Baylor was, and I don't know off the top of my head when they changed, but they were a 2-3 zone team for a while. Do you remember that?
Yeah. Like, yeah, sure.
So I always, because they're one of the few teams that actually beat Syracuse in the first round a couple of years ago. And it was because, like, you know, the old tournament thing, oh, they don't see the zone, they can't handle the zone. Well, Baylor handled the zone because they than his own team. So it doesn't surprise me that there were answers readily available. Once I give a few credit, did like what it's supposed to, right? Stymie you for a few possessions, stun you a little bit. A few against USC led with the press. And I don't remember if it was a diamond or a 1-3-1 press, but that really rattled USC and they never recovered. I mean, this was honestly like Gonzaga's USC game, but just reversed in a lot of ways. So
that's exactly right.
Yeah, I wish there was, like, I don't know, like, we do some sort of interesting viral compelling talking point moment. But yeah, let's switch gears to Few, Pat. I wrote a column about him tonight, and I was like, in no way did Gonzaga choke tonight or fall under the pressure. They just weren't as good. Like, I can't like digest anything other than they were clearly the inferior team. And I asked I asked Mark and Corey Kispert about being undefeated and the weight of it, and acknowledging my question, like, it wasn't going to change the game, but like, what's it like carrying that all year? Is there a collective weight that comes with it? Anything like that? And they, you know, not surprisingly, dismissed it in some ways. Kispert was like, it's a matter of who lost eight games. Basically, we weren't winning tonight. And I Few handled the whole night with class. Like, just, yeah, he used every aggregate aggressor term possible. You know, like aggressive, aggressor, aggression. Yes, he used them all to accurately describe the ambush that they got tonight. You know, I really think for Few, he will win a national title. And that basically, I wrote the column tonight. Like, this wasn't their night. This isn't a defining moment for them. Mm-hmm. It was a excellent team that wasn't as good as the best team. And it's very rare that we actually see the two best teams of a season in a title game. This was a terrible matchup for Gonzaga. It didn't work. If you have enough star-studded teams and you have enough high seeds, you will eventually win the NCAA tournament, just like all those coaches we talked about. There are all these guys who could win the big one.
Yeah.
And I wrote that Few is actually the best coach in college basketball now who has not won the big one. If Dan was on the podcast, instead of being drunk in Marco Island, he would say Bob Huggins was the best coach because Dan loves Bob Huggins. Few's now been to two title games. Huggins been to two Final Fours. I really think that Few's time will come. Does it come with Chet Holmgren and Hunter Salas next year? I don't know. But I do feel like they are soaring towards becoming a blue blood. And I don't know who knights you a blue blood, like, and how that happens. If there's like a double secret ceremony where it happens. But like, Gonzaga has made 22 straight NCAA tournaments, and they've had some really high end teams. And sometimes you just have a three seed that gets hot and you win it. Cause you know, like, it's just the tournament isn't necessarily determining of who is the best team in college basketball, right? It's like, who is the best team over a three-week stretch in that year? And eventually that will become Gonzaga if they continue on this plane. And there's no reason to think, with Tommy Lloyd there and the success they've had, they're kind of the it program right now, like, especially on the West Coast. How about no West Coast team has won it since 97?
Right. Yeah, Arizona.
Talk about a drought. So, yeah, your thoughts, Pat, on Few? I'm curious where you land on how to sort of rectify this season with such brilliance ending with such a thud.
Sure. No, I mean, he's absolutely the best coach to not win one at this point. And, you know, he's
take that, Wetzel.
Wetzel in absentia is outvoted. And we should note, by the way, that Wetzel will be asleep because it's 2:55 a.m. in Indy. But we are drinking a fine.
I don't know. I wouldn't put it past Dan to be on vacation, still up drinking beer right now, waiting on the pod. So
if he is and he's not participating in the pod, then he's in more trouble.
I really think Dan's vacation strategy, if his pictures glean into anything, is heavy day drinking. So he might not make tip off.
Yeah. Bet he didn't make the second half. I wish I didn't make the second half. But no, we're having an upland.
If it means anything.
Yeah. We're having an Upland Dragonfly, each of us. It's a Bloomington, Indiana beer. 2:55
a.m. I moved out of Miller Lite.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, I'm sticking with the local microbrew, and it's very good. But to get back to your question and my answer, yeah, he's Phil Mickelson right now. And Phil Mickelson eventually broke through winning majors and won a bunch of them.
Yes.
You know, and I think Mark Few absolutely will win one and maybe multiple. Next year, they may well start number one. If they get Chet Holmgren, I mean, that dude's like a whole different kind of freak, you know, a 7-foot wing, basically. You know, so I put nothing past them being the best team next year. You know, a couple things I noted in my column that, one, I still think, look, they've got to get stronger. You looked at Drew Timmy's body. And then you looked at the guys that he was trying to bang with, and it's a mismatch. You looked at the Davion Mitchell and the guards, just the shoulders and the arms and the chest on those guys. Gonzaga was smaller. You know, they weren't. It wasn't just you know, Timmy being put in pick and rolling, being spindled because of quickness. It was also Timmy not being strong enough to box out and go get rebounds with these guys, and on down the line for the rest of the Gonzaga guys. They've got to get better in the weight room, I think.
IPA bodies and, versus HGH bodies. I'm not insinuating anything, just a joke. But yeah.
Gonzaga's great. Gonzaga's going to be great. There's no foreseeable ending to them being an elite team. And eventually, as you said, you keep putting yourself in the mix. Eventually, the mix works out for you. You know, Virginia, Tony Bennett, same thing. You know, you get to a championship game, you win it, and some years you lose in the first round. That, you know, that's how it goes. But I don't think the Saturday game caused the Monday result. You know, like if in 2015,
I think the Saturday game predicted the Monday result.
Exactly. Yes, that was a foreshadowing, is what it was. Was like, holy cow, Baylor is playing great. Gonzaga is struggling like hell to beat an 11 seed. And it was a great game. I mean, the 11 seed UCLA played phenomenally, and it was an awesome game. But it was an indicator of who was on top of their form and who was not. Yeah, this was not 2015 where Wisconsin had to wage war against Kentucky and then just hit a wall. They were as good as, or if not better than, Duke and just hit the wall and couldn't finish. This game, Baylor was the better team from the jump. Here's my question. How good is Baylor? I mean, like, I think Baylor, this was a great team. They had two losses.
It really was.
Yeah, 28-2. And one of the losses was at Kansas a week after they came back from a three-week COVID pause. They were out for 3 weeks. They come back. They barely beat Iowa State. And Iowa State was terrible. And I talked to Drew, actually, the day before that game. And he said, we just had our first practice in 3 weeks on Sunday. I talked to him on Monday. I said, how was it? He said, it's a good thing we didn't have to play. And, I mean, they were terrible against Iowa State, and they were still very shaky and lost to Kansas. The only other game they lost was in the Big 12 semifinals. That's it, to Cade Cunningham and Oklahoma State. I mean, they were really good. And here's my stat. I told Sully I had a stat. First team since UCLA in 1968 to win both Final Four games by more than 15 points. UCLA 68 had Lou Alcindor. Yeah. So,
well, I mean, I'll try to outstat you. And I'm a terrible stat person. I'm a terrible numbers person. I'm pretty much a terrible person. But there has been, so everyone was like, oh, since 76 and 76, no one's been undefeated. We've actually had no one-loss teams win the title.
76. Yeah. Is that right?
I credit Bob Hamill, erstwhile scribe who hated a young Pat Forty in 1987.
Yes, he did.
For coming up with that stat. I had not realized that. But that's kind of like it. For as much emphasis we put on undefeated, that's how hard it is in college basketball. Nobody's even gone with one L. So a 2L like title team puts you in a pretty high echelon. And, you know, like, I don't know if Baylor would have gone undefeated the whole time, right? Because you can't sit here and say they would have, because we all have recency bias, et cetera, et cetera. And like, look, you get beat by the number of pick in the draft. That's life. That's happened. You're in the Big 12. You're not in the WCC, you know? And, you know, if Baylor had got cold in the second half and got beaten by Arkansas, Gonzaga's probably the national title winner tonight, right? Like, you know, that's the NCAA tournament, and that's life. But it's just, it's hard. It's tricky. It's that. But, all right, we've talked about this enough. Let's talk about the UCLA game, because we should have had an emergency podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. No,
that was so much better.
Yeah.
We could psychoanalyze Scott Drew's standing amongst the bitter coaching set for, you know, we could save that for June or something. Like, that was unbelievable. Right. You're obviously exponentially older than me, Pat. So, like, in the lexicon of buzzer beaters that you've seen, where did the Suggs heave rank?
Well, it's funny. I did write about that. I mean, we all did Saturday night. But to me, I mean, there's now the holy trinity of buzzer beaters in the NCAA tournament. It was Leitner, and then it was Leitner and Chris Jenkins, and now it's Leitner, Chris Jenkins, and Suggs. You could find reasons to put it third because, all right, if Leitner's shot misses, they lose. The other two, if they miss, it's overtime. This is our double overtime in the case of Suggs. The Jenkins shot, you could say, should be first because it literally won the national
championship. Wins the national title. Yeah.
Yeah. And Suggs even made reference to, you know, he makes a shot and the confetti comes out of the ceiling. So, you know, I mean, the finality of that was pretty epic. I think the Suggs's play was harder. Now, there was also luck involved by banking it in. But, you know, for him to individually take that thing and drive three dribbles and get 40 feet and launch and have that dead on, wow. I mean, that was incredible.
Did you think it was good when it left his hand? Yeah, you were up.
Well,
right?
I was up. Yeah, we've got, you know, the seating situation for the listeners is iffy at best if you have multiple reporters here. You can get one down and one up, one courtside, and then I was up basically in space. I was in like Noblesville, Indiana. From space, it looked pretty good, but I was behind the backboard, so you couldn't tell for sure whether it went in, but you could tell pretty quickly by the reaction. So, you know, it looked good. It was funny. Gosh, I talked to Larry Suggs, his dad, Jalen's dad. He had a great quote. You know, he said that when Jalen went up in the air, he said it was the longest second he's ever seen. You know, he said it seemed like he was up there forever shooting that thing. And, you know, Suggs comes down and starts running towards the Gonzaga fans because he thinks it's good. It's online. And lo and behold, he was right. What did it look like from courtside?
So I'm in zone opposite side. And I did not actually, Chuck Culpepper, who I gave a ride back to his hotel after the game, like we both did not realize it banked just because of the angles where we were. I like it left his hand and I'm like straight on. I'm behind the backboard too, but I'm low. So I like rise up in my chair and I lean to my left and I'm like that. I literally screamed, that's good. It was my most.
Oh my.
And I'm a pretty straight faced person on press row, as we're supposed to be and as we're paid to be, in my mind, and I could be wrong about this, is the second most like visceral reaction I've had to a moment to end a game. The most visceral being when I high-fived you after the Boise Statue of Liberty play in the moment of least press box decorum in the history of my career. It's probably good we didn't hug each other because that's really what we were feeling like for the Ian Johnson statue play from the immortal Jared Zebranski. So I like I didn't jump up out of my chair, but I like leaned. I was like, that's good. And then it like went in and then like, and then it's like, oh, wow, tonight's going to be busy. And like proceeded to write, which seemed like 72 stories. but here's one of my takeaways too. Like we've been at enough. We're very blessed in our careers. Right? We've been at enough great games, great moments, seen some great things. Like the thing that I think I will remember 10 years from now, other than the shot, the moment, and the exuberance, was Jalen Suggs like had a grasp of the moment that was like unlike any young 19-year-old athlete that I've ever seen. He was like calm, poised, clear-eyed, yet giddy and excited and authentic. And like he recalled the Chris Jenkins jumper, like he had just watched it on YouTube 10 minutes ago. He had seen like a GIF on Twitter that said, you know, Gordon Hayward had to walk so Jalen Suggs could run. Like his press conference, they should show that to every 16-year-old who thinks he's going to crush it on name, image, and likeness. You want to be like Jalen Suggs. Jalen Suggs was unbelievable in summing up the moment, the history. I'll never be able to relive that. You won't. Like Jalen Suggs can be like a 10-time All-Star and win three NBA titles, and people are going to ask him about that moment forever. And for him to grasp it, understand it, and know it like 14 minutes after the damn ball went in, that to me blew my mind.
I agree. I totally agree that I came away from that like, holy cow, this guy does have some sort of poise or presence, you know, of like he understood it, he appreciated it, he had perspective. I mean, it's like, wow, you know. But the best thing was too, he was also 18 years old. And he sat down in that chair before the Zoom call with the press, with us. And the first thing he did is he just laughed. Like, here I am sitting here after winning a Final Four game on a half court shot, you know, and he put his head back and he just is like, so there was that moment of like, holy cow, this really is happening to me. But then, yes, the understanding of kind of everything that went on, man,
it was like it happened 20 years ago, but it happened 20 minutes ago.
Right.
It was super, super impressed by him. I got I got a couple of texts from some of the football coaches today who had recruited him. And, you know, he was a really highly regarded high school quarterback. Kristen Peek and I had written about it on Yahoo a couple weeks ago. And yeah, some of the football coaches were like, you know what? I think Jalen made the right decision. You know, not playing football, play basketball. I think that's going to work out.
Yeah.
I think that's going to work out all right for Jalen. But I will say all the football coaches who I spoke to who had recruited him just loved him as a kid, loved him as a person.
Yeah.
Really thought it was the character shined through. He was an unrefined quarterback because he'd spent so much time playing basketball, obviously. And a lot of people saw a path to him being like, you know, a future All-American, you know, the kind of talent who could, whether it was quarterback or receiver, could have played in the NFL someday. But yeah, they were like, it's rare to see like a kid go somewhere else or pick a different sport or whatever and have all the coaches recruited him still like rooting hard for him. Like Matt Simon, the co-offensive coordinator at Minnesota, who was his primary recruiter. Like he's like, I mean, he's like the biggest Zags fan of all time. We were texting yesterday. Like he's just like, love the kid, wants a local kid to do well. Just people are just really fired up for Jalen, who saw him in that football snapshot.
Yeah, yeah, no, that's he does. He has some kind of special it qualities to him, you know. Funny, I maybe shouldn't say never, but I can't remember the last time I saw a five-star dive on the floor as much as he does. He is all over the floor, you know.
Constantly. I mean, great point.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, he is just a competitor, which is why he fits with the Gonzaga ethos, you know. But yeah, no, I mean, so your lack of decorum, since I was watching the game from Noblesville / outer space, I was able to exercise a lack of decorum as well. And I stood up and just yelled, "Oh!" Which was what I did at the kick six. You were down on the field. It's funny. We've been at the same games of some stuff now.
That's a good point. We've seen some stuff. Yeah.
We've seen some stuff. The kick six, we were both there. The Boise hook and ladder, flea flicker, Statue of Liberty, we were there. And then and we were there for this. It was pretty remarkable. And the I was at Kentucky Duke in 92, and the similarities between that game and this game were profound. There was so much in common, but we get to the end now. Duke finished the deal. Gonzaga did not finish the deal. So there's still that out there. All right, Pete, I want to ask you one other thing and then we can get to some North Carolina coaching news. But first, just overall tournament impressions. You know, your experience in Indy, your experience watching the games, covering the games.
You know, the first tournament I ever covered, if we're gonna go on the Wayback Machine here, was I want to say 97. I covered the Sweet 16, where you probably were there because it was DeJuan Wheaton, Louisville, and Syracuse. Does that ring a bell?
I was there. Oh yeah,
yeah.
Oh, I drank it at Fagan's and 44's that trip.
Yeah, I wasn't old enough to drink at both those bars at the time, but I was probably still there.
God. So. Oh my god,
I was a sophomore. Yeah, so I pretty much covered a tournament every year since then. I'm trying to remember if 97 covered a lot of NCAA tournaments in a row. Got blessed to do it. My favorite part of the job. I love the NCAA tournament. There's nothing better. So it was weird for me. I didn't go to the first weekend. I watched at home, wrote a bunch, was on a bunch of Zoom. So you're there, but you're not there. This tournament will be remembered as the cathartic tournament that made us all re-remember why we love the tournament. Like, the tournament had been this annual expectation for us, you know, as Americans since 1939. Even you didn't cover that tournament, Pat. But like, it just
no. But I remember really, watching it.
I really feel like you're a big tall fur fan. You had a tall fur like Zubaz outfit from Oregon. So I really feel like we were reminded of all those emotions. That's going to be like the defining part for me. Like, watching Jason Preston, watching Max A. Smith, watching Kevin O'Banner. You know, there was a weird part where you have a 1-in-8 shot when you're normally covering the tournament of being where the action is. Whereas when I was watching at home, something happened and I was like zoomed in and locked into these coaches and these moments. So you almost felt closer to it in a weird way, even though you were further away. That is what I will remember, is like the reinvigorating the connection of like what it feels like when a team wins and an upset happens and just like that, like adrenaline rush. But I will say this, and this isn't a criticism at all, but there was something missing covering the tournament. Now, I like one of my favorite days of the year covering sports is the day before the first day of the tournament, meaning if it's a Thursday start of the tournament and you're at a sub-regional or whatever they call the first day, and like the day before, there's 8 open locker rooms, right? So you go to the locker room all those 8 days and you see teams, assistant coaches, you know, administrators, like you get 8 snapshots of the dream, right? You have the 16 seed hoping and praying. I always go in the 16 seed locker room and I tell all the assistant coaches, just remember, I was the only one in here. All right. So when you win, but like it, to me, it's sort of like the ultimate snapshot of college basketball, right? It's the rich, it's the poor, it's the, what makes the tournament great. And so I really like missed getting to know, learning, gossiping, BSing with everybody. And then that helps fill in who these people are. Like if I had been at Oral Roberts, I would have talked to, you know, how'd you guys get at Max Asemus? Tell me about Kevin O'Banner. Like, so you learn these stories in an organic way that like when you're sitting at home waiting to react, you don't know. And so I feel like the players got robbed a little bit because their stories weren't told as well as they could have been this tournament. Because when you're in the locker room and you're around, like even like I joked with Brian Hamilton one day, he was sitting next to me. I was like, I just wish I could go up to an SID and ask him 3 questions right now. You know, because like you just didn't have the contact. It was just a, like a weird, and again, this is a little bit of inside baseball reporter stuff, but I really feel like there were great stories that weren't fully told because you got 10 minutes. Now, again, we can call the coaches. The SIDs are great. They could get your players on the phone, and they did that for me, and I'm sure they did that for you. But like there's a serendipity of like learning it. Something happens and you meet the moment and then you can kind of like understand the story holistically. And you just didn't have that in this tournament. And it's not a complaint. It's an observation. And it made me miss sort of the digging that goes into covering the tournament well. And I enjoy just sort of popping my head. And I remember going in the Robert Morris locker room the year they were 15 in Providence, and they very nearly beat Villanova and probably should have if it wasn't for a bad call.
Oh, I remember that.
Changed the direction of Mike Rice's career and life indelibly. But like, I remember, you know, Andy Toole was a coach and I was an assistant. I remember sitting in the locker room and like Andy Toole was like, you know, like, hey, we got a chance, you know, like that feeling of optimism. And that's just like a sporadic random example, but like learning about these teams, learning about these programs, you're meeting people, right? It's a huge, you know, how many times over the years have you met somebody for the first time, Pat, like who's become a source or somebody you got to know in an NCAA tournament locker room? I would think hundreds, right?
The person that just came immediately to mind was watching a guy coaching Richmond as a 15 seed in the late 90s, taking down a number 2 seed with a team of just cobbled together guys. And I wrote that guy, that coach, a handwritten note after the tournament. Like, I so enjoyed getting to know your players and watching. It was John Beilein. I mean, but that's the thing is, you know, like you watch that team and you go and you talk to the locker room and you meet those players. And it's like, this is so cool. And so, yeah, I write a note to John Beilein and he writes me back. And, you know, how many years later, 15 years later, he's playing in the national championship game. And then 5 more years after that. You know, it is very cool. And you're right that to me, you know, observing is such a big part of our job and getting to be there at the open practices and watch the faces of the players, especially the big underdogs, like, wow, we are here. And they're so excited and so happy. And you never know. I mean, you know, every once in a while, some of those will win games and where they're going to go. I remember loving the Northern Iowa team that ended up with Ali Farokmanesh making the shot to beat Kansas. I went and covered the Missouri Valley final. I was like, these guys are good. They're going to be a problem. And I didn't know they were going to beat Kansas. But, yeah, you know, you find these guys. You get to know a little bit about them. You watch them. You watch the faces. You watch the way they play. You see them interact. And it's just like, you know, you get much more of a tangible feel than we are allowed to get now. And let's hope that next year when we're covering the tournament, there are no cardboard cutouts, there are no masks, there are open practices, there are open locker rooms, and we get to experience it all. And I will say two people that came over to the media seating at the end there. One was was Scott Drew and said, thank you for all you do for college basketball and for covering us, which is like, wow, you just won a national title. That's very nice of you. And then two, Dan Gavitt, the VP of men's basketball for the NCAA, who, you know, poured as much sweat equity into this as anybody, more than really. And he could just sense the kind of the relief and the triumph of like, wow, we actually completed this thing. You know, it could, because there were a lot of times it didn't look like we were going to get anywhere near this.
But you talk about Dan Gavitt coming over, you know, tip of the cap from America to Dan Gavitt, quite frankly,
yes,
on the absolutely list of competent front facing NCAA employees. Dan Gavitt is one. And I don't really know where Mark Emmert would fall under him. But
I'm not sure there's a two. Is there a two?
Well, when you talk about front facing, they don't put a lot of people up front to face.
No.
And really, Dan Gavitt is not like seeking of that. But so this is a good story for the pod. So Danny Gavitt ran the Big East tournament for years. He was the Big East sort of associate commissioner of basketball. That's where I got to know him. I would cover the Big East tournament, work for the New York Times every year. And every year the Big East would go women's tournament, men's tournament. And so they'd be like long days, because Big East tournament back in the day would start on Tuesday and end on Saturday, which when you have four games a day, it's just like a lot of everything.
Right.
So end, Dan Gavitt, as traditions, you know, that it would be usually a 9 p.m. tip on Saturday. And after everything ended and they closed the guard down, it was usually St. Patrick's Day weekend, Dan Gavitt would go to McFadden's over on the east side and buy beers for all his staff. And throw up a Guinness to toast a successful tournament. Because when you're the Big East tournament is basically your moneymaker. And so if that goes off without a hitch and it goes well, et cetera. So there were more than one year where I toasted Dan Gavitt because I happened to be at the McFadden's with some of the Big East employees. And, a toast to...
He deserves multiple toasts. Last thing, we'll hit this and we'll hit it and we'll quit it. Can't ignore this, even though it happened on National Championship Day. North Carolina hired a coach, Roy Williams, unexpectedly, but kind of expectedly, stepped down last Thursday. Monday, bing, bang, boom, his assistant coach, Hubert Davis, is now the coach there. Your thoughts on staying in the Carolina family and whether this is a good move for the program?
I mean, my gut reaction is this going to be a great hire that's going to lead to national championships, or is this Carolina being myopic and staying in the family? My initial reaction would be that I really don't think it's that good of a hire. I really think that the North Carolina staff has not been great. The roster really isn't very good. If you look at where it's been compared to Carolina in the past, and if I'm Bubba Cunningham, I really would need from Hubert Davis a clear path to how North Carolina basketball is going to be better and different than it's been the last 2 years. I think 2 years ago, they were 6-14 in the ACC. This last year, they ended up in an 8-9 game and got completely smoked by Wisconsin. Like, North Carolina is a little bit just like everybody else right now. And how Hubert Davis is going to make them different is interesting. If you look at the Carolina staff right now, you have Steve Robinson, veteran assistant, was head coach at Tulsa a while ago, a little long in the tooth, not sure if he's like cut out for the next generation. And then you have Brad Frederick, whose only qualification to work for Roy Williams was really that his dad hired Roy Williams at Kansas. So nobody in the ACC would have told you in the last 5 years that Carolina had like a plus staff. It was like they had Roy Williams, they were Carolina. And quite frankly, Hubert Davis was not considered like an elite assistant. Like we've seen maybe some elite assistants go through there. And look, even the assistants we might have thought were very good don't work out. So it's a huge leap for Hubert Davis. And if there is continuity on the staff as it goes, now maybe Sean May gets bumped up, maybe Kendall Marshall gets bumped up, maybe they keep it in the family. But I almost think you need a little bit of jolt of outside the family for it to work. Yeah, I really think Roy undercut his twilight with a weak staff. And if they're doubling down on that weak staff, that's trouble.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. Is that you're asking something to get better with basically the same or perhaps lesser coaching acumen. Because Roy was a good coach. I mean, He did things pretty much by the Dean Smith book, but he had a really good sense for when to do things, you know, when to throw the trap on and when to, you know, change things up. And, you know, he was good. And we have no idea about Hubert. Really nice guy, worked with him at ESPN, wonderful person. But yeah, this could be a case where you're doubling down on familiarity and hoping it works with no real assurance that it will. I had somebody, you know, very much in the know there who said, you're going to see a different Hubert in a head coaching role than you saw in an assistant coaching role. Like he's going to be much more demonstrative, passionate. He stepped back, he said, it's Roy's team. Roy's going to do that stuff. That's not my role, but now is going to see more of that. But that still doesn't mean he can coach. I mean, we'll find out. But we have seen here and Indiana trying to perhaps recreate Michigan magic of, former player. Let's see what he can do. And, you know, staying in the family is, we've talked about it a million times on this podcast, is not necessarily a smart strategy. But I think it's very much this is very much a wait and see hire.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think if you're at Duke right now, you're smiling that they hired Hubert Davis. Now Duke's going to face its own crossroads. I don't think K has much more than a year left, right? They got their third top 10, top 15 recruit coming in next year. The third 5-star Trevor Keels committed out of the DC area, who's a big time player, right? Like to me, there's a lot of trappings of like, this is K emptying the clip. All right. But who do they hire, Pat? Right. I mean, this is like podcast fodder for a while, but like, there's nobody there. You hire John Shire. You don't hire Wojo. You don't hire Chris Collins. You can't really hire Capel. He can keep his roster
that's
together.
That's a fascinating one, because if they do hire an assistant, it's going to be perhaps even a bigger reach than Hubert. You know, I mean,
that's a good point.
I don't know. The K coaching tree is not blooming in full at the moment. So I don't know what they do. But I agree with you that day is coming pretty soon.
Yeah. So here's my thought on Carolina. Like, who's the best gettable sitting head coach you could have got? Like, gettable. I would think it's Chris Holt.
Yeah.
At Ohio State. Like,
I would say so. You know, I mean, I think Holtman would have, of course he would have done it. I think you could have gotten Billy Donovan, maybe. But there's a Roy Billy friction going back to the Brett Baerup days.
See, I think that's naive.
I don't think
sitting NBA coaches don't go to college. They just don't. I don't think we'll ever see a sitting NBA coach walk out with 2 months left in the season to go to college. Like, that's a Petrino move. I don't think that is going to happen. Like, it's not going to happen with Brad Stevens. It's not going to happen with Billy Donovan. Now, if Billy Donovan was in year six somewhere and was sputtering and you could kind
yeah,
of...
No, no,
but he's been in Chicago for 10 minutes. Like,
yeah, no,
he's part of a rebuild.
And
he's probably making
and
seven...
Billy's a loyalty year. Kind of guy. Like, if you gave him a job, yeah, you're right. He's not going to walk out on the job in his first year. That's not happened.
Yeah. And like, nobody wants to coach college basketball anymore. For the same reason Roy Williams doesn't want to coach college basketball anymore. It's a gong show. It's total free agency. It's complete chaos. Like, a quarter of the players are changing teams. No, good for them. They should be able to change teams. But like, that doesn't make it easy to manage.
Oh God, no. No. I mean, it's so foreign and yes, so transient at this point that I would like the paycheck, but I wouldn't like everything that comes along with it at this point.
Yeah. And if you're making $7 million and all you got to do is worry about guarding ball screens and you've got to worry about kissing 15-year-olds behinds and trying to court 19-year-olds and they're eight, yet they're paid. Nah, like that's like, it's not even a conversation. Like,
yeah.
It's not even, to me, it's not a conversation if you're Brad Stevens, if you're Billy Donovan. Now, I think that in
a different situation, like if Billy were not in his first year, that I think North Carolina would be the one place that he would come back to college for.
Yeah. And I'm not, Carolina's an elite job. It's the best job, probably. Right.
Yeah.
Like we got the podcast topic or another, but I can't think of one that's like, because it's like, better than Kentucky because there's like a little less crazy. And it's awesome tradition. Great place to live, all that stuff. You just don't have the kidney dialysis fights, which probably makes it a little bit better. But I really don't think any. Now, look, if you're 3 years into a 4-year deal in the NBA and it opens up in June and you can kind of clean break and they don't really want you anymore. Would someone leave the NBA for that? No. But when the whole Brad thing like happened, by the way, the mass whole I go to Dunkin' Donuts thing like endeared him to people in Massachusetts probably more than anything he's done his whole time there. But like Woj tweeted something that I thought was really, he's like, no one's ever going to leave for, you know, for NBA for college anymore. And I believe that. Like there could be some crazy extenuating circumstance, but for the most part, like they make more money. They have 1/100th of the headaches and they actually like these guys like the coach. Like they want to talk about ball screen defense till they're blue in the face. Thank God you people aren't listening to a podcast where we talk about ball screen defense until we're blue in the face.
See, that's when, all right, Wetzel's coming back on Thursday. We think if he sobers up enough to get on a flight back to Detroit. And so we will talk ball screen defense with Dan Wetzel then. We will berate him for missing the national championship podcast. But we thank you all for listening to the championship podcast. It's 3:35 a.m. and Sully has got to chop this thing up and get it ready for everyone's ears. So
Sully's the real hero
for us to sign off. And appreciate you listening. Subscribe. Leave us reviews. Be kind. Thanks for listening, and we will talk to you later this week.